it's been quite interesting looking at the sutras from this point of view, because I think some people, and even maybe some order members, think that this whole thing, this whole thing about the superpersonal force is a bit odd. It's a bit outside of Buddhism. You don't get it anywhere else. It's particularly Bante. But that isn't the case, actually. I think it's pretty common throughout the Mahayana. If you read Mahayana sutras, you get a definite sense that the Buddha is a force. And the job, one big part of our job is to give up to it, to let ourselves be influenced by that force. So I think the Mahayana, and perhaps especially the Pure Land Sutras, are relational. They're very much to do with your relation with the Buddha, who in the Pure Land Sutras, Amitabha, is a superpersonal force. And I'm going to sort of bring that out. I first came across this idea many, many years ago when I used to read Bante's seminars. This, when I was the early days of the Manchester Buddhist Centre, and we're talking now about 30-odd years ago, I used to spend the mornings reading Bante's seminars to sort of fill me up with the Dharma for the rest of the day. And it's the one, the door of liberation. And in there you've got a teacher's precepts, haven't you? Precepts gathered from here and there. And in there a teacher is talking about the bodhicitta. And in that seminar, Bante says, it's very interesting the way he's talking about the bodhicitta as a force, yeah, that you have to give yourself up to. It's not yours. It's something you give yourself up to. And then he said, the nearest he's ever come across this in Western literature is H.G. Wells, who had an experience towards the end of the war. The war, is that the First or the Second? I think it's the first, end of the First World War. H.G. Wells was very much an anthropologist. He was very much concerned with other people and community and so on. And the war just about did him in. He was very, very low by the end of that experience. His faith in humanity had taken a great knock. And he describes this in a novel called Mr. Britling Sees It Through. It's a very interesting novel. And just get my glasses so I can read it to you. This bit, not the whole novel. And Mr. Britling, his son has been killed in the war, and he had some German friends, and their son had come to visit them before the war, and he'd been killed as well, and he was completely demoralised by it all. And then he had this experience. Should have been moved, hold on a minute. And for this first time, clearly, he felt a presence, of which he had thought very many times in the last few weeks. A presence so close to him that it was behind his eyes and in his brain and hands. It was no trick of vision. It was a feeling of immediate reality. It was as if he had been groping all this time in the darkness, thinking himself alone amidst rocks and pitfalls and pitiless things, and suddenly a hand, a firm, strong hand, had touched his own, and a voice within him bade him be of good courage. "I have thought too much of myself," said Mr. Britling, and of what I would do by myself. I have forgotten that which was with me." Very moving passage, isn't it? As a result of this experience, as well as writing it down in this novel, Mr. Britling Sees It Through, he wrote a religious pamphlet called God the Invisible King. And in that pamphlet, he proposed a new way of understanding God, which was not God as the creator of the world, the universe, but God as what he called the captain of mankind, a force in the universe which you could tap into. And in this book, which I bought many years ago and read, I really followed it up, he describes it. "If a figure may represent him, it must be the figure of a beautiful youth, already brave and wise, but hardly come to his strength. He should stand lightly on his feet in the morning time, eager to go forward, as though he had but newly arisen to a day that was still but a promise. He should bear a sword, that clean, discriminating wisdom. His eyes should be as bright as swords. His lips should fall apart with eagerness for the great adventure before him, and he should be in very fresh and golden harness, reflecting the rising sun. Death should still hang like mists and cloud banks and shadows in the valleys of the wide landscape about him. There should be dew upon the threads of gossamer and little leaves and blades of turf at his feet. He is such a good writer, isn't he? Who does that remind you of? Very much like Manjushri, isn't it? We have to remember that H.G. Wells wrote a short history of the world, and in that history he spoke very well about the Buddha, didn't it? So he may have come across the figure of Manjushri in his, but anyway, it's very much Manjushri, isn't it? The Manjushri one is God the Invisible King, H.G. Wells, and you can get it on the internet. It's been well out of print for many, many years now, but you can get it on one of those publishing companies that publish really old books that a few people might be interested in, so you can get it there. Yeah, very interesting. So this is how I first came across the idea of bodhicitta as an other power from this seminar many, many years ago. So let's come back to the sutras then. And I want to speak about the two Sukhavibhuha sutras especially. Just get rid of that one. And there's the mystery of the missing sutra. I brought the sutra with me. I can't find it for the life of me. So I have got it on my computer, luckily. So let's look at the shorter Sukhavibhuha Sutra first. There's a passage, just to give you the outline of the sutra. What happens is the Buddha just starts speaking to Shariputra, and he starts telling him about Sukhavati, and he describes it quite shortly in a page or two, describes Sukhavati. And then he talks about Amitabha and Amitayas. Amitabha and Amitayas are the one person. It's the Buddha, who is either called Amitabha or Amitayas. In some of the sutras, he's mainly called Amitabha, and others, he's mainly called Amitayas. But it's the same character with just two different names. Quite interestingly, that Amitabha, as you know, means infinite light, and Amitayas, in eternal life. So you could see Amitabha as representing space and time, boundless space, boundless time. But halfway through the sutra, after the Buddha has described it, he says this: "Moreover, Shariputra, the progress of those living beings who are born in the Buddha field of the Tathagata Amitayas as pure bodhisattvas will be irreversible, and they will only experience one more birth. The number of these bodhisattvas, Shariputra, cannot easily be measured. It can only be said that there is an immeasurably large, innumerable multitude of them. Living beings," and this is the bit now, "living beings, Shariputra, should cultivate a heartfelt desire for that Buddha field." Now, heartfelt desire is Shraddhapa's translation of a Sanskrit word which has gone out of my mind. Pranidhana. Pranidhana? So where do you know Pranidhana from?
Sangravastus.
I'm a bit deaf, you'll have to speak.
Is it the Sangravastus?
It's not the Sangravastus.
The ten
connected.
Ten perfections.
No. It's the Bodhisattva vow. The Pranidhana is the Bodhisattva vow. That's very interesting, isn't it? So if we want to be reborn into Sukhavati, we have to have this heartfelt desire. Now, it doesn't say you have to cultivate the bodhisattva vow, and that you wouldn't have to cultivate the bodhisattva vow, because one of the lovely things about the Shorter Sutra is you've got shravakas and bodhisattvas there living together. It's a very broad church, and there's no hint in the Shorter Sutra that the bodhisattvas are better than the shravakas. They're all living together under Amitabha. Fantastic. But a heartfelt desire. And the way I understand this is that Sukhavati was created because of Dharmakara's pranidhana, his bodhisattva vow. It came out of his bodhisattva vow. So his heartfelt desire to create Sukhavati, that happened. And we need an equally strong heartfelt desire to be born with him. So there's these two heartfelt desires, his and ours, working together. And we'll look at that theme a bit more now. Then he says something very interesting, especially to us, order members and people involved with the Tree Ratna, because he says, why should they do this? Yeah, why should they develop this heartfelt desire for that Buddha field? They should do this because in that Buddha field, they will be in the company of good people, such as these bodhisattvas. Now, that is the only reason he gives to be born there. Yeah, he's just described Sukhavati. He's described the beauty, the pleasure, how wonderful it would be to be there. But that's not the reason he's giving to be born there. The reason to be born there is so you'll be in the company of bodhisattvas. So this is a restatement of spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. Yeah, and Sangha as practice. That's a bit by the by. And this evening, if you want, I can talk more about the Sangha in Sukhavati. But let's leave that for now. And then he says, Shariputra, living beings with only a few roots of virtue will not be born in the Buddha field of the Tathagata Amitayas. In other words, you need a lot of merit. You need to have really worked on your ethics in order to be born there. Then he says, if a son or daughter of good family hears the name of the Blessed One, the Tathagata Amitayas, and if their minds become absorbed by it for one night, two nights, three nights, four nights, five, six, seven nights, if their minds become undistractedly absorbed by it, then, when they die, the Tathagata Amitayas, surrounded by his Sangha of Shravakas and accompanied by his assembly of Bodhisattvas, will appear before them, and they will die with an undistorted mind. Undistorted mind. When they die, they will be born in the Buddha field of the Tathagata Amitayas, in the world system of Sukhavati. Therefore, Shariputra, it is with this purpose in view that I say a son or daughter of good family should single-mindedly cultivate a heartfelt desire for that Buddha field in their minds. There's a lot in that paragraph. There's a sixfold path. So let's go through them. Firstly, you need to cultivate a heartfelt desire, pranidhana. You could say, go for refuge. You need to commit yourself fully to it. You won't be born in Sukhavati with just the occasional thought, ooh, sounds nice, I'd like to be born there. Yeah, that sounds good. That won't work. You have to single-mindedly cultivate that desire, pranidhana, heartfelt desire to be born there, going for refuge. What comes next? Living beings with only a few roots of virtue will not be born there. So in other words, now, on the basis of you going for refuge, you need to practice ethics. So that's the second. That's the second stage. We're looking through, going through stages here. That's the second stage. Then, if a son or daughter, I like that. It's not just a son of good family. A son or daughter of good family. It's a very nice text, isn't it? It includes everybody within it. If a son or daughter of good family hears the name of the Blessed One, the Tathagata Amitayas, and if their minds become absorbed by it, yeah, subsorption, integration. Can you see where I'm going with this? Integration. for one night, two nights, three nights, four nights, five nights, six nights, seven nights. Interesting, it's nights, isn't it? Why nights? This is the Sanskrit version. The Chinese version has days. But the Sanskrit has nights. I'm reminded here of Pingya's praises. Do you remember? And he's telling his teacher about how brilliant it is. And his teacher says, well, why don't you go and live with him? He says, I don't need to. I'm with him all the time. I spend my nights revering him. Nights. For me, that represents something more than just your conscious mind. It represents your dream state, the imagination, once again. Anyway, if their minds become undistractedly absorbed by it, concentration, integration, absorption, then when they die. Now, I think the sutras mean this literally, that when you die, you'll be reborn in the Pure Land. But we can see this because they're works of imagination. They're not philosophical works. They're works of the imagination. So they work on many different levels. So you can understand this on the psycho-spiritual level as well as the literal level. That first of all, you go for refuge, heartfelt desire. Then you practice ethics. On the basis of that, you become absorbed in the Buddha. Absorbed in the Buddha. Then you die. Spiritual death. You could see the death as a spiritual death. What happens next? When they die, spiritual death, the Tathagata Amitayus, surrounded by his Sangha of Shravakas and accompanied by his assembly of Bodhisattvas, will appear before them, and they will die with an undistorted mind. Wisdom. They die with wisdom. Spiritual death. When they die, they will be reborn. Spiritual rebirth. In the Buddha field of the Tathagata Amitayus in the world system of Sukhavati. It's quite a similar list to the five great stages, isn't it? It's not exactly the same, but it's very, very similar. You've got going for refuge. You've got ethical practice, absorption, integration. The Buddha, devotion to the Buddha, undistractedly devoting yourself to the Buddha. Spiritual death, spiritual rebirth is all there. Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things, that each of the sutras is a bit different. They all have a slightly different take on the Pure Land. And they all have a slightly different take on the Buddha Amitayus. So, in this sutra, there's this... the first half of the sutra is about Amitayus, Amitabha, and his Pure Land, Sukhavati. And this bit is about Amitayus. But then it moves on to other Buddhas. You've got a long section now about just as I praise Sukhavati, so too in the East, as many Buddhas, as many blessed ones as there are grains of sand in the river Ganges, praise their Buddha fields, not Amitabha's Buddha field, their Buddha fields. And he mentions them. So in each of the directions, he mentions a whole load of Buddhas. Yeah. So now you've been focusing on Amitabha, but now it's lots of Buddhas. I can't remember now. I think it's 38 altogether, as far as my memory serves me. 38 Buddhas in all these directions, each one of them named. And then he says, at the end of each direction, he says, you should trust in this discourse on the Dharma called Embraced by All the Buddhas. So, trust in this discourse. So, as well as called the Sukhavati Sutra, it's also called Embraced by All the Buddhas. That's an alternative title for it. You should trust in this discourse on the Dharma called Embraced by All the Buddhas, which praises inconceivable good qualities. He says that a number of times. And then, towards the end, he says, Shariputra, why do you think that this discourse on the Dharma is called embraced by all the Buddhas? Those sons and daughters of good families, Shariputra, who hear the title of this discourse on the Dharma and who bear in mind the names of those Buddhas, those blessed ones which it mentioned, will all be embraced by the Buddhas, and their progress towards unsurpassed, perfect awakening will become irreversible. Irreversibility here is allied to being embraced by the Buddhas. To be embraced by the Buddhas, become irreversible. This is lovely, actually, because I think that in our order there's too much emphasis on me gaining enlightenment. Me becoming a stream entrant. Am I a stream entrant? Have I made it through the gateless gate, etc., etc.? But in these sutras, it's relational. Being embraced by the Buddhas is the same. To be embraced by the Buddhas is to become irreversible. Being embraced by the Buddhas is to become selfless. But instead of thinking about me and me becoming selfless, you forget about you and you look out. So it's the relationship. You're taken by the Buddhas. Yeah? You're just taken out of yourself by the Buddhas. There's no need to even think about it, about me and am I there yet, etc., etc. So selflessness comes about by forgetting about the self rather than working with the self. It comes about by putting your attention on the Buddhas, who are all beaming down their wisdom and compassion on us all the time. Now, that's the shorter sutra. This is supposed to be short, wasn't it, what I was going to do here? I'll try and be brief now for the next bit. I'm going to move on now to the longer sutra. The longer sutra is very much about Amitabha, Amitayus. He is not, in the shorter sutra, he's just an example of the infinite amount of Buddhas around the place. And you focus on him for a while, then you open up to all of them. The longer sutra is all about Amitabha, and he is the preeminent Buddha above all other Buddhas. And this is expressed by the fact that his light is infinite. Every Buddha has light. Every Buddha shines light out, but their light only goes as far as their Buddha field. That's their sphere of influence. Amitabha's light goes everywhere, the whole universe. So he symbolizes the Buddha principle, the Buddha principle in the universe. And it's interesting that hundreds of pages of text, what does he say? What is his teaching? Nothing. He says hardly anything. He says one thing in the longer Sukhavivyuha Sutra, and it's somebody asking him a question because he's smiling. And he says, why are you smiling? He says, oh, it's because of the vows I made ages ago. That's all he says. So there's no particular teaching of Amitabha. He's the silent Buddha. He says nothing. Any teachings at all come from the land, not from him. What is he? So what he is, the longer sutra tells the history, the mythic history of Sukhavati, how it came about. So long, long time ago, so long ago, you cannot possibly imagine it. So 81 Buddhas previously, there was a Buddha called Lokeshwara Raja. And in between each of those Buddhas, there's an inconceivably long number of kalpas. And you know how long a kalpa is, don't you? A kalpa is as long as it takes for a goddess to come down once every 100 years and stroke a rock 1 mile cube, stroke it with a piece of Benares silk. It has to be Benares silk. Benares silk. Every 100 years, she comes down and strokes that rock. And at the end of, when that rock has been worn down by that stroking, that is a kalpa. So inconceivable amount of kalpas between each Buddha, way back 81 times. Yeah. So you can't imagine that. You can't even imagine a kalpa, really, can you? But, you know, that is ridiculous. So as Banti says in his lecture series on the Mahayana Sutras, what we mean is outside of time. This is happening outside of time now. There's a Buddha called Lokeshwara Raja. And he had a disciple called Dharmakara, who took the Bodhisattva vow before Lokeshwara Raja. He took an extraordinary Bodhisattva vow because he wanted to build a Buddha land which is superior to all other Buddha lands. So he said, look, I want you to show me all the Buddha lands in all the universes. So the Buddha did that. And it took him 4 kalpas to show him all these Buddha lands. And so after that, he took all the best bits of them and he imagined this new Buddha field. He envisaged it in his mind. And then he took the famous vows. Yeah, the famous vows. It depends on which version of the sutra you read. There are 7 versions and they all have different numbers of vows. The famous Chinese one is 48 vows, but the Sanskrit one that Shraddhapa used has 47 vows. One has 17. They have all different numbers of vows. But the most important thing is it's not just a general vow. They are very, very specific vows. So 47, 48 vows he made to build this Buddha land. Now, the interesting thing about them is the grammar is very strange. I'll read you the first vow. And the first vow is to do with the fact that there will be no animals, hungry ghosts, or ashras, or hells in the Buddha field. Yeah, in his Buddha field. That's what makes a pure Buddha field, isn't it? None of those realms. But the way he puts it, it's the first of his vows. Blessed one. He's talking to Lokeshwara Raja. Blessed one. May I not attain unsurpassed perfect awakening if, when I have attained awakening, there are any hells in my Buddha field. Anyone is born there as an animal. There is a realm of hungry ghosts there, or anyone is born there as an asura. That first bit is strange, isn't it? May I not attain unsurpassed perfect awakening if, when I have attained awakening, this doesn't happen. It's very strange, isn't it? And all the vows are written more or less like that. It's a bit like saying, when I go to Italy for my holidays, if it's not sunny there, may I not go to Italy? Yeah. It's too late, you're in Italy now. Or let's say you wanted to be a doctor, you were training to be a doctor. If when I become a doctor, I don't cure people of their illnesses, may I not become a doctor? Yeah. It's written in that kind of way. And I think there's a reason for that. Gomez talks about the vows being spring-loaded, that they're conditional. When I have got my Buddha field, if this doesn't happen, may I not have my Buddha field? Yeah. So he goes through all these vows, and then you see him go through all the his lives as a bodhisattva, life by life, creating this Buddha field. And eventually, he creates the Buddha field and he becomes Amitabha. So Ananda says to the Buddha, did he do it then? Did he create a Buddha field? He said, yeah, he did. So the Buddha field has been created. That means that the vows have become true. So the spring-loaded nature of the vows is that the Buddha field wouldn't exist if the vows weren't true. So there is a Buddha field, and so the vows are true. So the next thing is to look at the vows. Now, some of the vows are about the land, some of the vows about the beings in the land, and others of the vows are how they affect beings who don't live in Sukhavati in all the other fields, yeah? And that includes us, yeah? So let me just read you one of them, the most famous one. In the Chinese version, this is vow number 18, the vow, what Shinran calls the primal vow. So let me read it to you. Blessed one, may I not attain unsurpassed perfect awakening unless, when I have attained awakening, living beings in innumerable, uncountable Buddha fields who have heard my name, who are intent on my Buddha field, and who dedicate their roots of virtue to be born there, even those who have only cultivated this thought 10 times. Are we born there? I'm sure you've got lost in all that. The way it's written is very strange, isn't it? I'll tell you what it said in a minute. This is with the exception of those who have committed the 5 acts which have immediate consequences, the 5 heinous crimes, or whose opposition to the true Dharma obstructs them from being born there. This is called the exclusion clause. You cannot be reborn in Sukhavati if you've done those terrible things. This is turned on its head in the next sutra, the Guanjing, but we won't go into that right now. What this vow says, if you take all this weird grammatical double negative structure out of it, is that when he's awakened, living beings in innumerable, uncountable Buddha fields who have heard his name, who are intent on his Buddha field, that means their intent, they're dedicated to it, and who dedicate their roots of virtue to be born there, they will be born there. Yeah. Even those who have only cultivated this thought 10 times. Now, I think there's been, this is quite an interesting one, because it starts off with much the same as happened in the shorter sutra, doesn't it? First of all, you need to be intent on that Buddha field. You could say that's a heartfelt desire. That's a necessary condition for being born there. And then dedicate their roots of virtue to be born there. You've got to have roots of virtue to dedicate to be born there. So those are the two things. And then he says, even those who've only cultivated this thought 10 times. That seems to be like an afterthought. It seems to come afterwards, yeah? Even if you've only done it 10 times. Now, how can that be possible? How can it be possible that you just think of the Buddha 10 times and you're reborn in his pure land? Surely that goes against everything in the Buddha's teaching, doesn't it? About depth and strength of practice and habitual karma, etc., etc. Surely this makes it too easy just to be born there 10 times thinking about the Buddha. That seems very unfair, doesn't it, on us who've been practicing for years and going to chapter meetings and confessing. And there's someone else who just thinks about the Buddha 10 times and they'll be reborn there. That surely that cannot be. But according to the sutra, it is. And I think what it's saying is, of course we have to practice, we have to dedicate our roots of virtue to be born there. The text says that. But this goes back to Bhante's teaching in the Bodhisattva Ideal, doesn't it? Do you remember the lecture, the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, Eternity and Time? Do you remember that lecture? Where he's talking about this whole idea of a path leading from where we are to enlightenment is a metaphor. And we have to be careful not to take that metaphor literally. Because the path doesn't only move through space, but it also moves through time. And if we're not careful, we're never going to get there, because Buddhahood is outside of time. Yeah. So we're going like this, 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 this. And there comes at a certain point, there has to come a certain point when you realise the metaphor is a metaphor. The meta of the path is a metaphor. And actually, Buddhahood is always eternally available. It's eternally there. That's what Amitabha's light really means. Let me just read you, this is the last bit of my talk today, I'm just going to read you another vow. This is vow 32. Blessed one, may I not attain unsurpassed perfect awakening unless, when I have attained awakening, all of the living beings in innumerable, uncountable, inconceivable, incomparable Buddha fields who are touched by my radiance are filled with a happiness which surpasses that of gods and men. So his radiance, his light, is shining out everywhere, the whole universe, including us. That's the Buddha principle. And if we allow it in, then it surpasses the happiness of gods and men. What does that mean? It's the happiness of wisdom. It's the happiness of irreversibility. It's the happiness of insight, illumination. The whole myth of Amitabha, the rather complex, long-winded myth of Amitabha, is basically saying Buddhahood is always present. The opportunity to suddenly see, to suddenly be illuminated, is always present, almost no matter what you've done. If you've done any of the five heinous crimes, you've had it at least for this life, it seems. But if you haven't, then there's nothing that you've done that is so bad that you're barred from gaining insight right now, at this very moment. In fact, I think the text would go so far as to say, if you don't really believe that's possible, then you're suffering from doubt. Yeah, that's why the text is all about faith. So although we often think about this long, arduous path that we're progressing along, yes, that seems to be the case for most of us. But at any moment, if we just open up, if we just allow Amitabha's light to touch us, then it can happen now. Because it's not you doing it. Well, it is you doing it to a certain extent, because you need the heartfelt desire, you need the kusala mula, you need the roots of virtue, and you need to absorb yourself in the spiritual life. But many years ago, hundreds of years ago, there was a debate within the Christian church about works and faith, wasn't there? What is it that gets you to heaven? Is it the work that you do, or is it the faith you have? And Gregory Palamas of the Greek Orthodox Church said, it's synergy. This is where the word synergy came from, the Greek Orthodox Church. It's not an American managerial term. It's Greek Orthodox Church, and it's the synergy of you doing your bit, practicing. But then, in our terms, we take it out of the Greek Orthodox Church's context into our church, into our Sangha. We do our bit by practicing, but we can't do it just on our own. We practice a certain point where Amitabha can come and greet us. Yeah, we practice up to the point of spiritual death, and then we have to let go of the self, and then let Amitabha embrace us. And the word embrace is parigraha. So graha, you've come across graha is grasping, isn't it? Grasping after something. Well, you turn that around and you are grasped, you're embraced by the Buddhas. That's the super what? Super personal force, yeah. And as Banti has said, it's not super personal force in the sense of impersonal. It's personal. That's why it's Amitabha. Amitabha isn't just the eternal Buddha principle. He's a person who you can relate to. This is quite interesting in a text called The 10 Doubts About Pure Land. 10 questions to Zhe'i. You know Zhe'i of Jhana of Beginners fame. He was a Pure Land Buddhist as well, and there's 10 doubts, and one of them is, why is it all based on Amitabha when there are so many Buddhas? And he said, well, you've got to have a relationship with somebody. Yeah, it's got to be personal. You can't just have a relationship with millions of Buddhas. You've got to focus in on one. But Amitabha represents all Buddhas. Amitabha is all Buddhas, you could say, in the Pure Land tradition. That's enough, isn't it? Yeah? Okay. So we'll go into the shrine room. And Subhadasi had the idea that we could share the reading around. I've only got it on my computer. So we could do it. It could be a bit awkward passing the computer around and then scrolling down. Would you like to do that? I'll read the whole thing. And that will be it for the day. So the only other thing is this evening. Have you had enough?
No.
You haven't. Okay. If you have had enough, then please feel free not to come this evening. Even if you've had enough now, you don't have to come into the shrine room. Feel free just to do what you need to do right now. So now the other thing is I could do either the Buddha this evening or the Sangha. So hands up for the Buddha. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. How many for the Sangha? Oh, overwhelmed. Okay, that's good. Because that means we can do another reading this evening. We can read the section on the Sangha, which is beautiful, gorgeous. Which way round should we do it? I'll just say a few words again here in the evening at 7:30, is it? Just to introduce you to some of the ideas of the Sangha. And then we'll just go into the shrine room and I'll read that section, or someone can read the section, maybe someone else can read it. I've got it on paper. And then, I don't know, maybe we can do a puja, something like that. Yeah. Good. Thank you.